said Joy. I'm dusting. It's tickling my nose. Brooke had left 2 voicemail messages today. She'd learned about Savannah firstly from her sister, and then apparently Logan had called the moment he left the house this morning, so she was now in a fine state. Joy knew that not calling Brooke earlier was an error of judgment. Brooke expected to be the first to find out about significant family developments. The truth was that Joy had put off calling her because she knew Brooke would react to the news of their house guest with incredulity, disapproval, and anxiety. And this was proving to be correct. Logan said he and Troy are helping this girl move out of her apartment tomorrow. Brooke was talking on the speakerphone as she drove home from work. It was irritating. Her voice kept fading in and out. Yes, Logan insisted on it, said Joy. He didn't want your father doing it on his own. He and Troy are going to drive Savannah to her apartment tomorrow and move her out. Then she'll never have anything to do with that vile man again. She moved into the living room, holding her cloth aloft, and started on the tennis ball collection. Stan owned 43 signed tennis balls contained in small glass boxes, and it was amazing how the glass containers collected a thin layer of dust in such a short amount of time. When he died, the signed balls would be the first thing to go. Some of them were probably fake. She'd read somewhere once that sports memorabilia fraud was booming. "What if the boyfriend turns up?" asked Brooke. "It will be 2 against 1, said Joy. "Your brothers can take care of it." "What if he has, a knife?" Joy paused. "Surely he wouldn't have a knife. Should they take knives too?" "Oh, my God, Mum!" Brooke exploded. Her excessive reaction calmed Joy. She wasn't sending the boys into an active war zone. Savannah was quite positive that the boyfriend wouldn't be there, and even if he was, Troy and Logan were very big, strong, intimidating men. Everyone said so. They'd be fine. She wouldn't let them take knives. To be honest, part of her still didn't trust the boys with knives, as if they were still little kids who might cut themselves or each other. She knew there was a very significant contradiction in her thinking right now. "He's not going to be there," said Joy. "He's a graphic designer, apparently, like Indira. I wonder if Indira knows him. I guess that's unlikely. Indira gave me a lovely new fridge magnet, did I tell you?" She kept telling people about how much she loved the magnet to hide the fact that she couldn't stand to look at it because she'd been so crushed when she opened it. She'd been idiotically convinced it was an ultrasound picture and that Indira was hiding somewhere in the garden, watching her reaction. Mortifying. "No, Mum, you didn't mention that Indira gave you a lovely fridge magnet," said Brooke. Joy recognised the tone. She used to speak to her own mother with the same forbearance. "Anyway, the boys will be fine," said Joy. "I can't believe we need to get involved with these kinds of people," fretted Brooke. "These kinds of people?" repeated Joy. "What do you mean, these kinds of people?" Brooke had never, ever been snooty. Joy hadn't brought her children up like that. Troy liked to strut about like a peacock, flicking his shiny black credit card onto the table at restaurants. "I'll take care of this," he'd say. But it was funny when he did it. "Oh, you know what I mean, Mum," said Brooke. "No, I don't know what you mean. You didn't grow up in Downton Abbey, darling." "It's nothing to do with money or class. I just mean people where there might be criminal element?" "We've got plenty of criminal elements in our family. Your own brother was a drug dealer. Troy just sold weed to the private school kids. You make him sound like a drug lord. He just, you know, saw a gap in the market." "I can assure you that Savannah is a nice girl in a difficult situation," said Joy crisply. I'm sure she is a nice girl, and it's awful what happened to her, but she's a stranger and she's not your responsibility. You've got enough on your plates. There was that new condescending tone that had begun to creep into Brooke's voice ever since Stan had his knee operation, as if she were just weighed down with the onerous responsibility of taking care of her aging parents. It was sweet, but also mildly aggravating. What are you talking about? We've got nothing on our plates. Not a thing. Our plates are empty, darling. Joy hadn't fully understood how bored she and Stan had been until Savannah arrived on their doorstep. Savannah gave Joy and Stan something interesting and new to talk about, and she was so sweet and grateful and pretty. And Savannah isn't a stranger anymore. Joy peered at Agassiz's scratchy ballpoint signature on the ball as she polished. Every person you meet starts out as a stranger. Your father was a stranger when I first met him. You were a little stranger when I first met you. She saw Brooke's outraged little red face as the doctor held her up like an animal he'd rescued from a trap. Amazing to think that angry, helpless baby was now this opinionated young woman. You didn't let Dad move into your house the moment you met him, said Brooke. No, but I let you move in, said Joy, which she thought was rather witty. But Brooke's laugh sounded hollow. Anyway, she hasn't moved in, Joy reassured her. She picked up the Navratilova ball. This is temporary, obviously. She spoke in the brisk, businesslike voice she used with the accountants. It's just until she gets back on her feet. There's really nothing to worry about. You'll like her when you meet her. Logan liked her today, I could tell. You know what she's doing right now? Going through your jewellery, said Brooke. Stealing your identities? Sometimes she sounded so much like her father. I don't own any jewellery worth stealing, said Joy. She's welcome to it. No, she's cooking dinner. Pasta. The scents of garlic and onion wafted from the kitchen. This is the third time she's cooked. She keeps insisting. She says she loves to cook. Do you know how wonderful it is to have someone else cooking for you? Well, you do, because Grant cooks. There was a moment's silence, and then Brooke said plaintively, I've cooked dinner for you, Mum. Of course you have, soothed Joy, many times. Brooke was a perfectly competent cook, like Joy herself, but also like Joy, she took no obvious pleasure in cooking, grimly plunking down plates with a put-upon sigh. Joy's family had been, and still were, big eaters. Keeping her family fed had been a never-ending, arduous task, and now that it was just Joy and Stan, she had to force herself into the kitchen each night with the thought, this again? Savannah, on the other hand, cooked as if it was a lovely pastime, not a chore to endure, humming and cleaning as she went. Brooke didn't answer. And Joy heard the traffic in the background, the angry toot of someone's horn, and she imagined her daughter behind the wheel, frowning, worrying about that damned new clinic that Joy wished she hadn't so bravely started, worrying about her parents who didn't yet require her concern. The time will come, my darling. We'll get frail and sick and stubborn, and your stomach will twist with love and terror each time we call. But plenty of time. Don't get ahead of yourself. We're not there yet. The thing is, I hate cooking, said Joy. The words rushed out of her mouth, traitorously, venomously. You've no idea how much I hate cooking, and it just never ends, the cooking. Night after night after bloody night. Each night at 5 o'clock, like clockwork, your father says, what's for dinner? And I grit my teeth so hard I can feel it in my jaw. She stopped, embarrassed. Gosh, Mum, said Brooke. She sounded shocked. We should get one of those meal services for you if you really hate cooking that much. I had no idea you felt like that. All those years. You should have made us help more when we were growing up, but you never let us in the kitchen. I feel terrible. No, 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 interrupted Joy. She felt ridiculous. It was true she hadn't let her children help in the kitchen. They were too messy and loud, and she didn't have the time or patience to be the sort of mother to smile lovingly while a flowery-faced child cracked eggs onto the floor. She would be that sort of grandmother. Grandchildren would be her second chance to get it right. Now she had the time and the eggs to spare, and she would be present with her grandchildren. When she looked at photos of her children when they were little, she sometimes thought, did I notice how beautiful they were? Was I actually there? Did I just skim the surface of my entire damned life? I was being silly. I don't really hate cooking. I just like it when someone else puts a meal in front of me, as if I'm the lady of the manor. And it's no big deal at all now, when it's just for your father and me. It's easy. Now, how are you? How was your weekend?
It was nice, said Brooke. Quiet.
A sudden instinct, something about the tension in Brooke's voice and the memory that Brooke had said she might drop by over the weekend, but then never had, and Joy had been so busy with Savannah that she only just remembered now, made Joy say, did you have a migraine over the weekend, Brooke?
So what else has this Savannah been doing all day, said Brooke at the same time, apart from cooking?
She's been resting, said Joy. She needed a rest. I think she's been through quite a stressful time. For the first couple of days, Savannah had slept for long stretches, as though she were recuperating from a serious illness. And Joy and Stan had tiptoed about the house, giving each other quizzical shrugs. Initially, Savannah hadn't spoken at all, just gratefully eaten whatever food was put in front of her. It was gratifying to see the colour come back into her cheeks. As the days went by, she became chattier, and she seemed so interested in Joy and Stan's lives, and to truly enjoy hearing their stories and looking at family photos. She asked them all about the tennis school. How did they come to start it? What was it like in those early days? Was it hard to find students? Did they still play? Did none of their children want to take over the business? It was Stan who answered all those questions, who seemed to want to answer her questions. He kept getting in first. It was so unlike him. As if he needed to do this, as if her interest was fulfilling some sort of therapeutic need, giving him closure, perhaps. Savannah nodded along and never seemed to get impatient when Stan spent 10 minutes trying to work out if a particular tournament had taken place in 1981 or 1982.
And what does Dad think about all this? Asked Brooke.
Without waiting for an answer, she said, suddenly suspicious, has he got her on the court yet?
Does she play?
She was so transparent, always a daddy's girl. It was Stan's approval she so desperately craved, as if it were withheld from her, and yet she'd always had it, from the moment he first held her. Brooke was Stan's favourite. Everyone knew it, except for Brooke. Savannah doesn't play, said Joy. She says she's not sporty. But your dad likes her. It was actually surprising how well Stan and Savannah got on. She and your father have bonded over some television series they both enjoy. They talk about the characters as if they're real people.
Which series? Asked Brooke urgently, as if that mattered.
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't know, said Joy. She'd never been a big fan of television, and the older she got, the less patience she had for it. Her lower back played up as she sat still for too long,
whereas Stan had gone in the other direction and would sit in that recliner for hours watching rubbish.
Right, said Brooke.
How's Grant? Asked Joy. And how's work? I gave your card to someone the other day. Now, who was it? Someone who said they were having back pain, just like me, and I said, well, you must see my daughter. And he said, Amy said something about Dad buying her a car?
Brooke's voice was sharp.
Who? Savannah? He's not buying her a car. We were just talking about how we'd need to get her set up with a car at some point, and your dad was asking her if she'd consider the new Golf. So they went and test drove one. You know how your dad loves test driving cars, even if he has no intention of buying one.
How is she going to afford a car? Does she even have a job? Asked Brooke.
I think I already told you that she and her boyfriend had only just moved here from Queensland, said Joy.
So why doesn't she just move back to Joy, dinner?
I've got to go. That's Savannah calling to say dinner is ready. She walked towards the kitchen, the phone to her ear.
How did Dad react to the news about Harry's comeback? Asked Brooke.
Oh, well, Savannah has been a good distraction, said Joy, lowering her voice, knowing Stan was already in the kitchen sorting out their drinks. She could see Savannah through the doorway with three plates balanced on her forearms like a waitress. Her haircut looked lovely.
It will be interesting to see what he says about Dad in his autobiography, said Brooke. Do you think Dad will read it? Or will it upset him too much?
Autobiography? Joy stopped. She spun around so she was facing away from the kitchen.
Supposedly he's writing one, said Brooke, or he's probably paying a ghostwriter to write it for him.
Would they ever be free of that boy?
I didn't know that.
She should have predicted it. All the big names in tennis wrote their stories eventually. Everyone loved a success story. Their "So You Want to Write a Memoir" teacher had said rags to riches and overcoming the odds were the most popular themes for memoirs. There was something demeaning about Joy doing Caro's silly memoir writing course, while Harry, a kid whose bloodied, skinny boy knees she'd once bandaged, wrote a proper memoir that people would actually want to read. It made Joy's entire life feel silly. A lady's life.
Will you read it? Asked Brooke.
I don't know, said Joy slowly.
Probably.
She heard the low timbre of Stan's voice as he spoke to Savannah in the kitchen. She walked to the couch, sat down, and picked up a cushion. She caressed its soft, tasseled fringe while she monitored her reaction to this revelation. Her heart had quickened, but it was certainly not racing. There was really no need for concern here. After all, she and Stan represented only one chapter in Harry's illustrious career. Harry would simply trot out a more detailed version of the, by now, well-worn raffle ticket story. How Harry's father, Elias, won the private lesson at Delaney's, gave the lesson to his son, first time the kid ever held a racket, blah, blah, blah. There would be no further revelations. Harry knew nothing. He'd been a kid. His eyes firmly fixed on his future. His readers wanted to hear what it was like to win Wimbledon. They wanted Harry's secrets, not his father's secrets, not Joy's secrets. She saw Elias Haddad's handsome face, that slow, sensual wink. It used to make her blood run cold. She'd see him at an interstate tournament and think, don't you dare wink at me again, Elias. But sure enough, he'd wink at her over the heads of their oblivious children, as if it were all just a joke. Well, she refused to be worried. She would put it out of her mind. It was all so long ago. No need to dwell on things, her mother used to say. Everyone did far too much dwelling these days. I must let you go, darling, she said briskly to Brooke. I know you're busy. She could smell her dinner waiting for her. She replaced the cushion in the corner of the couch. We'll see you on Sunday for Father's Day. You can meet Savannah then. She'll still be there. There was a crack of genuine distress in Brooke's voice. On Father's Day? Joy lowered her voice and her head to the phone once more. Darling, she said. There was a myth in Joy's family, one that Brooke liked to perpetuate, and the myth was that even though Brooke was the youngest and the one with the debilitating health condition, she was the most robust of the Delaney children, the least sensitive, the one who had her professional and personal life sorted, and that Amy, the oldest, who should therefore have been the most responsible, was the flaky, fragile one, who was always getting her feelings hurt. But Joy knew better. She knew exactly what lay behind the facades her children presented to the world. Yes, Amy had her mental health challenges, but she was as tough as nails at her core. Logan pretended not to care about anything, but cared about everything. Troy acted so superior because he felt so inferior, and Brooke liked to present herself as the most grown-up of them all, but sometimes Joy caught the fleeting expression of a frightened child crossing her face. Those were the times Joy wanted to gather her 6-foot-1 daughter in her arms and say, "My baby girl." "Savannah won't find somewhere to live by the weekend," she told Brooke. "No, of course not," said Brooke. She sounded flat and distant now. "That's fine, Mum. This is a really kind thing you're doing, and I'm glad you're getting a break from cooking. I'll see you Sunday. Love you." "Love you too," said Joy. But Brooke had already hung up. Joy went into the kitchen, where Stan had put 3 wine glasses in a row on the island bench, white for Savannah, red for Stan, a spritzer for Joy. Savannah put a big green salad in the centre of the table and angled the good shiny silver salad servers just so. Someone had given Joy those salad servers years ago and she'd never used them, as if no occasion was ever good enough, not even Christmas, that Savannah automatically used all the nicest things in Joy's kitchen on a daily basis. The good placemats, the good glasses, the good cutlery, and consequently, dinner each night felt festive and delightful. She had a knack for setting the table. Joy's mother used to have that knack, and Joy had not inherited it. Tonight, Savannah had even picked a little sprig of cherry blossom and put it in a tiny vase she'd found in the back of a cupboard. "Music?" Joy held up her phone, head on one side. Asking this made her feel like she was maybe in her 30s, living in a share house like Amy. She had never in her life lived in a share house. Logan had helped her set up her Spotify account ages ago, but like the salad servers, Joy hadn't found the right occasion to use it until Savannah came to stay. "Yes, please." Savannah moved deftly behind her to pick up the salt and pepper grinders from the sideboard. "This pasta looks delicious, Savannah," said Stan. He would never have said, "This looks delicious, Joy," about something Joy had cooked, although occasionally he might grunt, "Looks good," as he picked up his fork. Stan's formality was just like the good crockery and cutlery. It added a nice sheen to the night. He winked at Joy, just a loving, husbandly wink without subtext, and she thought about his hands on her body last night, his voice low in her ear, and as the first notes of Neil Diamond's "Sweet Caroline" filled the kitchen, Joy let any thoughts about Harry's memoir and her worry about Brooke fade away as a deep sense of contentment spread throughout her body, as blissful as a fast-acting paracetamol. Chapter 14. Now.
Did you kill your wife, Mr. Delaney?
Aye.
The old man, huge and hunch-shouldered, with reddish thumbprints under his eyes, lifted his bald head, seemingly bewildered by the question.
What's that?
The baby-faced journalist in a natty suit and tie shoved a chunky microphone towards his mouth.
Did you have anything to do with your wife's disappearance, Mr. Delaney?
The old man stood on the front lawn of his suburban house, shoulder to shoulder with his four adult children, surrounded by a semicircle of journalists and camera operators. The journalists were all young, in smart, casual, brightly coloured clothes, no patterns, solid colours, sharp shoulders, their faces smooth and opaque with makeup. The camera operators were older, all men, with ordinary, impassive faces and weekend hardware shopping clothes, jeans and polo shirts.
Mr. Delaney? That is defamatory. Get away from him, you parasite!
It was one of the old man's daughters who spoke. She slapped the microphone, a swift, smooth backhand. She was a tennis player, apparently. They all were. One of her brothers stepped forward, a protective arm in front of his father's face. But the other two siblings said and did nothing. They appeared instead to take tiny steps away from their father. And the internet saw. Minds were made up. Two of his children think he did it. Chapter 15. Concerns are growing for a Sydney woman who has not been seen for 10 days. Police have today launched an appeal for information on the whereabouts of retired tennis coach Joy Delaney. The 69-year-old was reported missing by her adult children, and officers have been unable to locate her. Family members say they received a text message on Valentine's Day described as out of character. It is believed that she may have been riding a green bicycle with a white wicker basket. A search of local bushland and bike tracks involving more than 100 volunteers from the local community has found no sign of her. Police are requesting that anyone with CCTV or dashcam footage in the local area please come forward. A silver Volvo has been seized as part of the investigation and will be tested forensically over the next few days. Investigators are keen to talk with a former visitor to the family home, Savannah Pagonis, who may have important information. Police have stressed that Ms. Pagonis is not a suspect or a person of interest. Any piece of information, no matter how small or seemingly trivial, could prove crucial at this point, said Detective Senior Constable Christine Akuri. The missing woman's husband, Stanley Delaney, is helping police with their investigations.
Helping police with their investigations, murmured Teresa Gear as she carefully cut out the article from that day's paper with the big kitchen scissors, as was her habit, even though her children teased her for it. It was strange how everyday habits like clipping newspaper articles had suddenly become antiquated. She couldn't decide if she would show this clipping to her daughter when she got back home from her appointment. Obviously, Claire would have already heard that her ex-husband's mother had gone missing. It would be worrying and confusing for her. There was nothing worse than having to feel sorry for people who had wronged you. You don't want lottery wins for your enemies, but you don't want tragedies for them either. Then they got the upper hand.
Damn those Delaneys.
Teresa had once been fond of the Delaney family, but that had all changed in an instant 5 years ago. She would never forget her daughter's shattered face when Claire told her what Troy had done. Not only had he broken her heart, but it was all Troy's fault that Claire was now married to an American. A nice American, but an American who lived in America.
When Troy and Claire had been married, they had lived one of those hybrid lives where they continually travelled back and forth between the US and Australia, as if New York and Sydney were merely a bus ride apart. That's how Claire became friends with a Texan girl in New York called Sarah, who eventually invited her to her wedding a year after Troy and Claire had split up, which was where Claire met Sarah's divorced brother, Jeff. And there was nothing wrong with Jeff, except for his address. Austin was a very fun and friendly city, but so was Sydney. Her new son-in-law just smiled when she pointed that out. He wasn't quite as interested in her as Troy had been. Troy had been kind of flirtatious with her. Teresa had enjoyed his flirtatiousness. It upset her now to remember that. They'd all been hoodwinked. Jeff was no Troy. He hated flying. He didn't want a hybrid life. He wanted a life where Claire saw her Australian family maybe once a year. Claire was back in Sydney now, staying in the spare room, which was wonderful. But once she got back on that plane, Teresa might not see her only daughter for months. So thank you for nothing, Troy Delaney. She pushed the point of her scissors against the headline of the newspaper article, "Concerns Grow for Missing Woman." His damned mother would choose to disappear right now, of all times. She had liked Troy's parents. They were just an ordinary, down-to-earth couple, like her and Hans. She had imagined them all being grandparents together. Surely she would have noticed if there had been cracks in their marriage that could have led to something catastrophic. But that was 5 years ago, and maybe every marriage had secret cracks that could turn into chasms. She laid down the scissors and crumpled up the carefully clipped newspaper article into a ball. She wasn't going to say a word to Claire about her former mother-in-law unless she mentioned her first, and then she'd tell her that, yes, it was upsetting, but she must try her hardest not to be upset. The Delaneys were nothing to do with them anymore. If only that were true. Damn that Troy Delaney. Chapter 16. Last September. Troy Delaney watched the streets of his childhood glide by from the passenger seat of Logan's car. Lush lawns, sharp-edged hedges, ivy-covered brick walls. A postman on a motorbike slid a single letter into an ornate green letterbox. A magpie swooped violently towards a cyclist's helmeted head. A dog walker trotted after three little designer dogs. A young mother pushed a double stroller. There was nothing wrong with any of it. There was nothing to complain about, except for the magpie. He hated magpies. It was all perfectly nice. It was just that the unrelenting niceness made him feel like he was being lovingly suffocated with a duvet. He closed his eyes and tried to recall a cacophony of noise and canyon-like streets of New York, where he'd been 24 hours earlier. But it was like Sydney suburbia cancelled out New York's existence. Now there could be nothing else but this soft, bland reality. His older brother driving, a tiny, smug grin on his unshaven face, because Logan knew Troy didn't want to be here. "Love the scarf, mate," he'd said predictably when he saw Troy, who'd worn it just to annoy him. "You look really intimidating." "Pure cashmere," Troy had answered. "This is really very kind of you guys," said a low female voice from the back seat. "It's not a problem." Troy turned and smiled at the girl sitting composedly behind them in his brother's shitbox of a car. Savannah. His parents' bizarre little charity project. She sat upright, her hair pulled back in a schoolgirl ponytail to reveal slightly protruding, tiny ears, like an elf's. Her pale face was makeup-free.
She had the kind of thin, bony body and hard face that speaks of addiction and the streets. There was a nearly healed cut over one eye with faint purplish bruising, and Troy tried to feel the sympathy she obviously deserved, but his heart was as hard and suspicious as an ex-girlfriend's. Troy's parents had no idea that being abused didn't automatically make you good. Savannah could be a petty thief, a psychopath, or just an opportunist who had seen their big house and soft, elderly, innocent faces and thought, money. He and Logan were the muscle in case the boyfriend showed up. Troy covertly checked out his older brother, who didn't have a gym membership but still looked gallingly buff, although he'd stacked it on around the belly. He wondered what Logan could bench press, if he could ever be convinced to bench press. How would they handle it if this guy did make an appearance? When Troy was in his angry young man stage, he would have relished the opportunity to hit someone with justice on his side, to defend a wronged woman, to blow off all that angry energy. But he no longer walked around with his teeth clenched as tight as his fists, looking for someone to blame. That stupid, angry kid no longer existed. Now the thought of being involved in a physical altercation seemed grotesque. He gripped his fist, watching his knuckles. Did he still know how to hit someone? What if everything went pear-shaped and he got charged with assault? He imagined a 20-year-old cop handcuffing him and leading him away, hand firm on the back of his neck. To lose control of his life would be unbearable. If he got arrested, he'd no longer be able to travel back and forth between Sydney and New York. He knew how lucky he was that he didn't have a youth criminal record to cause difficulties at the borders, which he sailed through with such ease and regularity. It was all thanks to his mother that he'd been let off with a caution when he'd got caught with cannabis during his entrepreneurial days. She'd arrived like the cavalry, following a phone call from Troy's girlfriend at the time, and launched a full-on Joy Delaney charm offensive that had taken down the older of the two police officers. Troy had just 10 minutes earlier made a profitable sale to the school captain of an elite school, which meant he had a lot of cash on him, but only a small amount of drugs. Small enough that he could argue it was for personal use. Troy could tell the younger officer badly wanted to charge him, that he represented something that guy couldn't stand. "Your luck won't last forever, mate," he'd said to Troy, hatred in his eyes. "Don't talk to me. Don't even look at me," his mother had said, rippling with fury on the drive home. His mother was also the one who'd somehow magically convinced Harry Haddad's father not to call the police when Troy punched the kid in the face for cheating. "If I'd been there, I would have called the police on you myself," Troy's dad had said. "Your dad would never have done that," Joy had told him in private. "He's just upset." But his dad had said those words and never taken them back. Apparently, Harry Haddad was going to release an autobiography next year. Troy wondered if he'd include the story of how his first coach's son jumped the net and nearly broke his nose for cheating. Presumably not. Didn't fit with his wholesome brand. Troy wouldn't be reading the fucker's book anyway. He hated Harry for dumping his father even more than he hated him for cheating. Troy shifted in his seat, kicked at an old subway wrapper caught on the tip of his shoe from the floor of Logan's car, and for no reason at all found himself considering what had happened in New York, even though he had not given his brain permission to consider it. In fact, he had expressly forbidden himself to think of it again for another 24 hours. His ex-wife had met him for a drink and presented him with an ethical dilemma so excruciating he thought it might have given him an instant stomach ulcer. Did people still get stomach ulcers? Nobody seemed to talk about them anymore. The word ulcerate seemed appropriate for the sensation he experienced at that moment. Like a tiny cyst had burst and flooded his stomach with corrosive acid. "This is not about evening the score," Claire had said with a tremulous smile after she'd taken a sip of an overpriced, over-accessorised cocktail. She'd flown in from Austin just to talk to him. Logan turned onto the highway and stopped at the first traffic light. A dead bat hung from the power line. Whenever Troy left his parents' place, he got a red light here and thought, "I always get a red light here." And then he looked up and thought, "Isn't that dead bat always there?" He got trapped in a permanent loop of pointless thoughts. Further down the road, a bus had stopped and a handful of people disembarked. Troy saw an ancient old lady totter towards the bus stop, face desperate, arm raised. She reminded him of his long-dead grandmother, who'd drunk too much and was spiteful to his mother. But Troy had adored her. She had a scar from when her husband, the grandfather Troy had never met, threw her across the room. She wore the scar with pride, like a tattoo she'd chosen for herself. "I threw that bastard out of my house," she told her grandchildren. "I said, I never want to see your face again. And I never did." The last passenger emerged from the bus. The old lady picked up the pace. Troy reached across Logan and banged his fist hard on the horn to get the driver's attention. Too late. The doors slammed shut. The bus took off. For fuck's sake. Logan looked at him sideways. "She'll get the next one." Troy kicked again at the subway wrapper. "Ugh! Christ almighty, it's stuck on my shoe. Oh, God, that yellow fake cheese will stain." "Looks like you're due for some new shoes anyway," said Logan. "They're brand new Armani suede loafers," protested Troy. Logan smirked. Troy reached down and grabbed the subway wrapper, scrunched it into a ball and shoved it in the side pocket of the car door, which was filled with coins, a pair of service station sunglasses missing a lens, and a CD without a cover. "When did you last clean your car? Sometime back in the 90s? "Troy would rather not be seen in my car." Logan looked at Savannah in the rear vision mirror. Wait, did he just wink at her? He wouldn't be flirting because he was in a long-term relationship with Indira. Indira was way out of Logan's league, as far as Troy was concerned. It was a mystery what these women saw in him. The only skill Logan had was recognizing the good ones. Sometimes Logan saw something in a woman that Troy didn't see straight away. When they were in their late teens, they'd both dated girls called Tracy, and Troy developed a secret, shameful crush on Logan's Tracy. She was the superior Tracy. The worst part was, Troy had met Logan's Tracy first, so he could have made a move, but he didn't see her appeal until Logan saw it. "You've got a fancy car, Troy," said Savannah. "What type is it?" They'd taken Logan's car because he had a bigger boot for Savannah's stuff. Troy was happy not to park his car outside Savannah's flat, which he assumed was in some crummy low-rent area where it would get keyed within 5 minutes. "It's a McLaren 600LT. Troy tried to say it in a neutral tone and ignored Logan's inevitable faux-awed whistle. "How much does a car like that cost?" asked Savannah. "Is that rude to ask?" "Are you kidding?" said Logan. "He's always looking for an excuse to bring his net worth into the conversation." "Fuck off," said Troy, because, as a matter of fact, the very last thing he wanted discussed in front of this potential con artist was his net worth.
What do you do, Savannah?
He turned around to look at her again.
For a living.
Is that rude to ask? Savannah turned her head and spoke to the car window.
Bit of this, bit of that.
Her nose piercing glinted.
Mostly retail. Hospitality.
So she'd worked as a checkout chick and a waitress. She turned away from the window and looked at him deliberately, her chin lifted.
We'd only just moved here to Sydney, so I hadn't lined up any work yet. Obviously, I will once this is...
She gestured at her forehead.
I'm not intending to sponge off your parents forever, if that's what you're thinking.
I didn't mean that, said Troy, embarrassed and wrong-footed, and irritated that he'd been made to feel that way. He turned back around to face the front and shifted in his seat as he tried to straighten his legs. He thought of the lavish legroom on his Emirates flight from JFK, the stunning flight attendant leaning down to refill his wine glass, bringing with her a cloud of seductive perfume. Baccarat Rouge 540. He knew he had it right, but had checked, to be sure. And now here he was, in a car that smelled of bacon. He shifted position in his seat. Shifted again. He sensed Logan noticing and made a decision not to move for the next minute. He counted it in his head. One elephant, two elephant, three elephant. He made it to 30 seconds and then he had to move. He was 11 years old, the Delaney kid, incapable of sitting still.
Sit still, Troy Delaney, his teachers used to roar.
And sometimes, if he liked the teacher, he would try to sit still. He would try so hard, truly. But his body just moved of its own accord, as if he were a puppet with a malicious master tugging strings to jerk his limbs. He gave up trying and let his legs jiggle and his fingers drum against his thighs.
And what do you do, Troy? Said Savannah.
For a living.
I'm a trader, said Troy.
What do you trade? She asked. He knew she'd lose interest in a moment. Everyone did.
Anything that moves.
I don't know what that means, said Savannah humbly.
Nobody does, said Logan.
Troy didn't look at him.
It means anything with volatility. Interest rates, equities, currencies, commodities. That's my bread and butter.
You're a risk taker, then, said Savannah. And he looked at her in the rear vision mirror again and saw that she had her head bowed and was examining her fingernails.
A calculated risk taker, said Troy.
His family thought he played blackjack all day long. Logan said something under his breath.
What?
Troy looked at him. Logan lifted a shoulder.
Didn't say anything.
How could he have that smug grin while driving a car filled with Subway wrappers?
Do you have a partner?
Asked Savannah.
He's straight, said Logan. Just likes to act camp.
Do you? Said Savannah to Troy. She lifted her head, interested.
Like to act camp?
Apparently so, said Troy. He didn't care when people thought he was gay. He kind of liked it. Kept everyone on their toes. He didn't do it on purpose. Or maybe he did. To differentiate himself from Logan, who was a man's man. Logan thought there was only one way to be a man, their father's way. Silence filled the car as they drove down the highway, every traffic light inevitably turning red as they approached, causing Troy to just about lose his mind. Logan hummed under his breath, elbow halfway out the car window, head back against the headrest, as if he were a layabout teenager off to the beach with his friends. He probably still went to the beach with his friends. They probably had barbecues and played beach cricket. Logan was still in touch with his entire circle of high school friends, which made Troy feel both contemptuous, how parochial, how very Sydney, and envious. Troy liked the idea of old friends, just not the reality. When old friends tried to get in touch with him, he always shuddered. It was like they were trying to take something away from him, to peel off an outer layer and show everyone the uncouth, unsophisticated kid he used to be. He was always kind of surprised old friends still existed. Logan continued to whistle. The guy needed a haircut, a shave, probably a shower, for fuck's sake. It was the same toneless, two-note tune Logan used to hum on long car journeys to tournaments when they were kids. The tune that would malevolently worm its way into Troy's consciousness until he had no choice but to resort to violence. Because come on now, how many times did he have to ask him to stop? Don't. He touched Logan's shoulder. Please, don't. Logan stopped humming abruptly. He glanced once at Troy, switched on the radio, and changed lanes unnecessarily. Troy closed his eyes so he didn't have to see the next traffic light turn red, and it occurred to him that maybe Logan's humming was a nervous tic, and in the way that a random thought about your childhood can suddenly offer a startling new adult clarity, he saw in a flash that this was true. Logan hummed when he was nervous. He had hummed on the way to tournaments because he was nervous, and Troy couldn't stand the sound of it because he himself had been suffering pre-game nerves. So Logan was nervous right now. It wouldn't be the threat to his own safety worrying him, but the possibility of being involved in a disagreement. Logan had a severe conflict allergy. He'd pick up his cutlery and eat rather than tell a waitress, "That's not what I ordered." Even if it was vegetarian. When he used to play the most notorious cheats on the circuit, he never questioned their calls. It was his brother's most significant and, for Troy, most mystifying flaw. Of course, Logan's conflict allergy hadn't applied to Troy. The two of them used to fight to the death. Troy traced his finger down the faint white line on his forearm. 16 stitches. He and Logan had smashed through a window onto the front lawn while they were fighting, like a scene from Die Hard. Logan had a similar scar on his thigh. It was one of Troy's favourite childhood memories, the two of them looking at each other with shocked, thrilled eyes, bloody limbs, glass fragments shining in their hair, their poor mother screaming her head off. Now, Logan competed against Troy by not competing, which was fucking genius. He couldn't win if only one of you was playing. Savannah spoke up from the back seat. "When I said that about not sponging off your parents, I hope I didn't come across as ungrateful." Troy opened his eyes. "Not at all." He slid the words "at" and "all" together to make the one word "at all," a linguistic habit he'd taught himself as a teenager, when he'd heard it used by someone on the radio and decided it sounded sophisticated. It still gave him pleasure, like a fashion choice. He saw the harbour and his heart lifted at the sight of apartment blocks, office towers, skyscrapers, the harbour bridge. Civilization, even if it was only Sydney civilization. not proper civilization. Savannah continued talking. Like, I'm really grateful to you both for doing this and to your parents. Your parents are fab. Fab. Odd choice of word. Circa 1990? They're like one of a kind. Amazing people. Truly. Amazing people. Troy looked at Logan. They'd heard a lot of that growing up. Your parents are so cool. Your parents aren't like other parents with boring office jobs. We wish we had parents like yours. It's all good, said Troy. No problem at all. He twisted around to smile his most dazzling smile at her. She smiled back. A girl had once told Troy that he had a devastating smile. He secretly treasured that compliment. Devastating. So we take a left here, right? Said Logan. Troy jerked his head. He had not bothered to ask the location of Savannah's unit, but had assumed they were heading over the bridge to some suburb he'd never heard of, way out in the boondocks, right under a flight path or two. Instead, he saw they were driving through a hip harbourside neighbourhood where he himself had lived in his 20s. He'd had after-work drinks at that pub on the corner. He'd taken dates to that little Thai restaurant. This was an area for IT guys in hoodies, junior execs in high heels, and law graduates in new suits. People here were too young and happy, attractive and cashed up to hit their girlfriends. Go straight at the roundabout, said Savannah, and then it's the big apartment block right there. That's it. There's heaps of visitors parking. Troy craned his neck. We must have good views. He realized he was now feeling more sympathy towards her, as if someone who lived in this suburb really didn't deserve a violent boyfriend. His neck turned red with shame. Our unit doesn't face the harbour, said Savannah. It's just a one bedroom. They reduced the rent because it's got a really crappy kitchen and bathroom. It's the only unrenovated apartment in the building. It was like she was explaining how they could afford to live here, like she'd seen his neck and read his thoughts. Logan parked, and he and Troy got out of the car, unwinding their bodies with relief, the way men of their height did when released from cars and aeroplanes. Logan removed from the boot a couple of supermarket cardboard boxes that their mother had given them for Savannah's belongings, while Troy stuck his hands in his pockets and kicked his heels against the pavement. He looked about for any nefarious types, but the place was deserted. Everyone would be at work right now. This wasn't an area for young families. Is she getting out? Troy said to Logan after a moment. Logan shrugged. He ducked down to look. She's just sitting there. Should we give her a second? Said Troy. Logan shrugged again. It was like his default gesture. They waited. How's Indira? Asked Troy. She's fine, said Logan, his face blank. You still living? Yes? Logan cut him off. So they were still crammed together in that crummy one-bedroom townhouse Logan had bought decades ago. Troy's mother had mentioned that Indira wanted to move a few years back, but that had obviously gone nowhere. How is New York? Logan asked, without discernible interest. Great, said Troy. As far as Troy knew, Logan had never been to New York. Imagine never having been to New York and acting like it didn't matter. Did Logan even have a passport right now? The thought of not having a valid passport made Troy hyperventilate, but Logan seemed to live his life within the confines of a tiny radius encompassing his workplace, their parents' house, and the homes of his married with children high school friends. Today's exciting adventure to Savannah's apartment might be the furthest Logan had travelled in years. It wasn't like he hadn't had the opportunities. Logan was offered a tennis scholarship to the University of Chicago 2 years before Troy was offered one at Stanford, but he'd turned it down. He'd said, "No thanks, I'm good," without apparent regret. In fact, all four of the Delaney children had been offered tennis scholarships to prestigious American universities. Troy was the only one with the brains to take the offer, the only one capable of seeing what a chance like that could mean to a Sydney public school kid. It still infuriated him. His brothers and sisters could have changed the direction of their lives. They thought it was a decision about tennis. They didn't get that tennis was merely the key that unlocked the door to a bigger, shinier world. Tennis didn't just get Troy into Stanford, it kick-started his career. His family enjoyed that story. Once, he'd even overheard Logan recounting it, how Troy was in New York doing a summer internship, competing against a group of terrifyingly slick young graduates for a coveted permanent position, when one day a grey-haired guy came into the office and said with quiet menace, "Which one of you kids is the tennis player?" Troy raised his hand and the guy said, "I'll pick you up after work. Full whites, please." Troy had to run into Macy's in Times Square. It wasn't Times Square, it was Herald Square, but he'd given up correcting his family. His mother said Times Square sounded better in his 15-minute lunch break, and buy the first white clothes he could find. No time to try them on. A shiny black car took them out to a pompous tennis club where they played doubles against two guys, one old, one young, who they decisively beat. Six love, six love. Turned out the scary grey-haired guy was the big enchilada, and he hated the other old guy for a reason never explained. There were a lot of hard-eyed smiles that day. Guess who got the permanent position? Yes, his family loved that story. They loved any story where a Delaney won a match or won anything. But it was almost like he needed each of his siblings to say, "I should have taken the scholarship like you, Troy. Then I'd have a life like yours." When in fact, all three of them seemed to view Troy and his life's choices not with envy, but with a kind of amused, detached superiority, as if money and success were shiny, childish toys, comical and absurd. It was true that Brooke's migraines gave her hell when she was a teenager, so she had no choice but to quit tennis altogether and stay in Sydney to study. Amy was Amy. She couldn't cope with the stress of competitive tennis. He never got his older sister until the day she explained it. Think of your worst pre-match nerves, except there's no match, it's just Tuesday morning. That's how it feels to be me. But Logan should have said yes to Chicago. He'd been smarter than Troy at school, and he had that incredible forehand. Did he ever do anything with that brain or that forehand? Troy tried to imagine his brother in a classroom teaching. Who exactly took these classes? And what exactly did he teach in business communications? How to format a business letter? How would Logan know? Had he ever sent one in his life? People emailed these days. He imagined Logan wearing a cheap Kmart tie, one their mother had probably given him for Christmas, standing at an old-fashioned blackboard scribbling in chalk, "To whom it may concern, yours faithfully, dear sir, madam," and then shrugging whenever a student asked a question. To be fair, he was probably a good teacher. He'd been the best out of all four of them at coaching and the only one who seemed to actually like it. He got that same fixed, focused look on his face as their dad did when he watched a kid play. Any kid, even the useless ones. Logan was probably only 14 when Troy heard him say, You look away from the ball at the last second to a little kid who Troy would have written off as having no hand-eye coordination. But that was tennis. Logan couldn't feel passionate about spending his days teaching business communication skills to help little wannabe business people enter a world Logan had no interest in entering himself. It was just wrong. Logan was leading the wrong life and didn't care. And for fuck's sake, why did Troy care that he didn't care? When he was a kid, all he'd wanted to do was beat his older brother in anything and everything. It was the point of his entire existence. Winning his first match against Logan had felt like a cocaine high. Except, just like cocaine, it also made him feel sick. He always remembered, with resentment and mystification, how nausea had tainted the edge of his win, how he'd gone to have a shower to cool off and thought he was fine, but then he lost his temper with a tennis kid who had wandered through the back door into their house. He hated it so much when kids thought their kitchen was a clubhouse facility. It was almost like he'd felt guilty for beating his brother, as if being 2 years older gave Logan a lifelong right to win against Troy. These days, their father seemed to be equally impressed, or equally unimpressed, by the careers both his sons had chosen. Brooke was the only one who impressed their dad, because she was his favourite and she was starting her own business. Stan didn't seem to notice that Troy had also been his own boss for years. This was what happened whenever Troy saw his family. He regressed. His emotions started to gallop all over the place. He wanted to beat Logan when Logan wasn't even playing. He got jealous of the attention his dad showed his baby sister for her little physiotherapy practice. For fuck's sake, you would think he was Amy. It was humiliating. "You were in New York for work, right?" said Logan. "And pleasure," said Troy. There was no point talking about the work part. Whenever Troy tried to explain what he did for a living, his family would get the same expressions of focused yet vacant concentration, as they might if they were trying to tune into an out-of-area radio program and were only hearing every 20th word through the static. His mother, bless her heart, had even subscribed to a podcast, Chat with Traders, and took notes while she bravely listened to it. But to date, she was still none the wiser. "So, been on the court lately?" Troy gave Logan a speculative look. It had been years since they'd played each other. Logan gave an irritated exhalation, as if Troy had asked this same question multiple times before, which he was pretty sure he had not. "No, not for a while now." "Why not?" asked Troy, genuinely interested. "Not even with Mum and Dad." "No time." Logan fiddled with his left wrist as if to indicate an invisible watch. "No time," repeated Troy. "What a crock of shit. You've got time to burn." Logan shrugged. Then he said suddenly, as if he couldn't help himself, "I don't get how you play socially." He said socially like the word smelled. "I enjoy it," said Troy truthfully. He had friends he played with on a semi-regular basis, both in Sydney and New York. They were all former competitive players like him. He won maybe 70% of the time. "Keeps me fit. It doesn't matter anymore." "You're saying you don't care if you win or lose?" "Obviously, I play to win," said Troy, "but it's not life or death." They contemplated each other. They were exactly the same height, although Troy preferred to think he had just a fraction on his older brother. It was probably just his hair. He used mousse. Logan said, "I don't mind having a hit, but the moment we're scoring, I start to care if I win or lose, and then I just He paused. I can't stand it. He looked warily at Troy, as though waiting for him to throw this revelation back in his face. After a moment, Troy said, But you still follow the tennis, right?
Sure, said Logan.
I don't follow it. Don't even watch the finals, admitted Troy. If it's on TV, I switch it off. I can't stand watching it.
There were still a couple of guys playing in satellite tournaments who he and Logan knew. Guys they'd beaten. Logan gave a half smile, half grimace, to show he got it. Troy understood why Logan couldn't play. Logan understood why Troy couldn't watch. Tennis was complicated for all of them.
What about the girls? Asked Troy, suddenly curious. He should know this, but Logan was more involved with family life than him.
Brooke plays with Dad fairly often, said Logan. I don't know about Amy. The last I heard of her having a hit was that time she grifted that beach volleyball player.
They both grinned with identical derision. Beach volleyball. Every now and then, Amy dated a loser who didn't believe it was possible for a woman to beat a man in any sporting endeavour, even if tennis wasn't his sport. She generally capitalised on their sexism with a cash wager. They stood for a moment in uncharacteristically companionable, brotherly silence. And Troy considered telling Logan what was really filling his mind right now. Something of zero consequence and yet mind-bending significance, depending on how he chose to shift the prism of his perspective.
I saw Claire in New York. He could begin.
Logan would raise an eyebrow. He'd liked Claire. Claire had liked him. He would listen with interest and without judgment. Logan couldn't be bothered to judge.
But no, Troy wasn't ready to talk about it yet, and anyway, at any moment, Savannah would get out of the car and interrupt them. He shoved his hands in his pockets. Was the chick gonna sit there forever?
Logan began his toneless whistle, and Troy felt his mind break free.
Fuck this.